only 10 knights in civilian clothes. They had been dressed in green to celebrate the festival of spring. Agravain was among them. He had attached himself to Guinevere lately to spy on her, and Lancelot had been left out on purpose. Well, they had been riding home cheerfully, all chattering and bloomy and branchy, when Sir Meliagrance had leapt up at their feet in an ambush. The top draw business had preyed on his mind, till he had determined to be ungentlemanly in earnest, if everybody accused him of being so. He had known that the Queen's party was unarmed, and that Lancelot was not with them. He had brought a strong force of archers and men-at-arms to take her captive. There had been a fight. The Queen's knights had defended her as best they could with swords and falchions, until they were all wounded, 6 of them seriously. Then Guinevere had surrendered to save their lives. She had made a bargain with Sir Meliagrance, whose heart was not really in the business of being a blackguard, that if she called her defenders off, he must promise to take the wounded knights with her to his castle, and he must let them sleep in the anteroom of her chamber. Meliagrance, loving Guinevere, flinching at his own half-hearted wickedness, and knowing the hopelessness of forcing his beloved against her will, had agreed to terms. The poor fellow had never been cut out to be a villain. In the confusion of getting the sorry procession of hurt men slung across their horses, the Queen had kept her head. She had beckoned the little page, who had a fresh and fast pony, and she had secretly slipped him her ring with a message for Lancelot. When he saw his opportunity, he was to gallop for his life, and he had done so, with the archers after him. Here was the ring. Lancelot, halfway through the story, was already shouting for his armour. By the time it was told, Arthur was kneeling at his feet, strapping on the greaves. Chapter 42. When the mounted archers rode back crestfallen, saying that they had been unable to shoot the boy, Sir Meliagrance knew what was going to happen. He was distracted with misery, not only because he knew that he had been acting unwisely and wickedly, but also because he was genuinely in love with the Queen. He still had a kick in him, however, and he saw that after having gone so far it was too late to retreat. Lancelot would be bound to come in answer to the message, and it was necessary to gain time. The castle was not ready for a siege, but if it could be got ready, there would be a fair prospect of making terms with the besiegers, considering that the Queen would be inside. Sir Lancelot must be stopped at all costs, until the castle had been put in posture of defence. He guessed correctly that Lancelot would come riding helter-skelter to the Queen's aid as soon as he could get himself armed. The best way of stopping him would be with a second ambush at a narrow glade in the wood which he would have to ride through, a glade so narrow that archers would certainly be able to kill his horse, if not to pierce his armour. Since the troubled times, all roads had been cleared of undergrowth for the distance of a bowshot on either side, but this glade, on account of peculiarities in the terrain, had been overlooked, and a well-shot arrow at fair range could penetrate the best armour, as Meliagrance knew. So the ambush was sent out post-haste, and everything within the castle was at 6s and 7s. Herdsmen were driving beasts into the keep, and all the beasts strayed or got muddled with each other or would not go through the gates. Pump boys were feverishly bringing water to the great tubs. It was one of those futile castles which appear to have originated in Ireland, whose bailey was without a well. Maids were running about on the verge of hysterics, for Sir Meliagrance, like many people out of the wrong draw, was determined to receive his captive queen in a way which would be above criticism. They were making boudoirs for her, and taking the tapestries out of his bachelor bedroom to go in hers, and polishing the silver, and sending to the nearest neighbours for the loan of gold plate. Guinevere herself ushered into a small waiting room, while the state apartments were made ready for her reception, added to the confusion by insisting on bandages and hot water and stretchers for her wounded men. Sir Meliagrance running up and down stairs with cries of, "Yes, ma'am, in half a minute," or, "Marion, Marion, where the hell have you put the candles?" or Murdoch, take them sheep out of the solar this instant. Found time to lean his forehead against the cold stone of an embrasure, to clutch his bewildered heart, to curse his folly, and further to disarrange his already disordered plots. The Queen was the first to get her affairs in order. She only had the bandaging to arrange, and naturally her wants were the earliest to be attended. She was sitting with her waiting women at one of the windows of the castle, a sort of calm centre in the middle of the whirlwind, when one of the girls called out that something was coming down the road. "It is a cart," said the Queen. "It will be something to do with the provisions of the castle." "There is a knight in the cart," said the girl, "a knight in armour. I suppose somebody is taking him away to be hanged." In those days, it was considered disgraceful to ride in a cart. Later, they saw that there was a horse trotting behind the cart, which was coming at a great gallop, with its reins dangling in the dust. Later still, they were horrified to see that all the entrails of the horse were dangling in the dust also. It was stuck full of arrows like a porcupine, and trotted along with a strange look of unconcernedness. Perhaps it was numbed by shock. It was Lancelot's horse, and Lancelot was in the cart, beating the cart horse with his scabbard. He had fallen into the ambush, as expected, had spent some time trying to get at his assailants, who had escaped the heavy dismounted iron man easily by jumping over hedges and ditches, and then he had set out to walk the rest of the way, in spite of his armour. Meleagrance had counted on the impossibility of such a walk for a man dressed in an equipment which may have weighed as much as himself, but he had not counted on the cart which Lancelot commandeered. A measure of the great man's anxiety about the Queen on this occasion is that he is said to have swum his horse across the Thames at the beginning of the ride, from Westminster Bridge to Lambeth, in spite of the fact that if anything had gone wrong, his armour would certainly have drowned him. "How dare you say it was a knight going to be hanged?" exclaimed the Queen. "You are a hussy! How dare you compare Sir Lancelot to a felon?" The wretched girl blushed and held her tongue, while Lancelot could be seen throwing his reins to the terrified carter and storming up the drawbridge, shouting at the top of his voice. Sir Meliagrance heard of the arrival just as Lancelot was bursting in at the great gate. A flustered porter, taken by surprise, had tried to shut it in his face, but received a blow on the ear from the iron fist, which knocked him flat. The gate swung open, undefended. Lancelot was in one of his rare passions, possibly on account of the sufferings of his horse. Meleagrance, who had been overseeing some men-at-arms while they broke up the wooden sheds on the great court as a precaution against Greek fire, lost his nerve. He sprinted for the back stairs and was already kneeling at the Queen's feet, while Lancelot was raging round the porter's lodge, demanding the Queen. "What is the matter now?" asked Guinevere, looking at the extraordinary, vulgar man who sprawled before her, a look, curiously enough, not without affection. After all, it is a compliment to be kidnapped for love, especially when all ends happily.
"I yield! I yield!" cried Sir Meliagrance. "Oh, I yield to you, dear Queen! Save me from that Sir Lancelot!"
Guinevere was looking radiantly beautiful. It may have been the maying, or the compliment which the Cockney knight had paid her, or some premonition such as comes to women before their joy. At any rate, she was feeling happy, and she bore no grudge against her captor. "Very well," she said, cheerfully and wisely. "The less noise there is about this, the better for my reputation. I will try to calm Sir Lancelot." Sir Meliagrance positively whistled with relief, he sighed so hard.
"That's right," he said. "That's the old cocksparrow. Beg pardon, I'm sure. Will it please your gracious majesty to stay the night at Meliagrance Castle when you've been and calmed Sir Lancelot for the sake of your wounded knights?"
"I don't know," said the Queen.
"You could all go away in the morning," urged Sir Meliagrance, "and we could say no more about it. It will be more regular, like. You could say you was here on a visit."
"Very well," said the Queen. and she went down to Sir Lancelot, while Sir Meliagrance mopped his brow. He was standing in the inner court, shouting for his enemy. When Guinevere saw him, and he saw her, the old electric message went between their eyes before they spoke a word. It was as if Elaine and the whole quest for the Grail had never been. So far as we can make it out, she had accepted her defeat. He must have seen in her eyes that she had given in to him, that she was prepared to leave him to be himself, to love his God and to do whatever he pleased, so long as he was only Lancelot. She was serene and sane again. She had renounced her possessive madness and was joyful to see him living, whatever he did. They were young creatures, the same creatures whose eyes had met with the almost forgotten click of magnets in the smoky hall of Camelot so long ago. And in truly yielding, she had won the battle by mistake. "What is all the fuss about?" asked the Queen. They had a light, bantering tone. They were in love again. "You may well ask." Then he added in an angrier voice and flushing, "He has shot my horse." "Thank you for coming," said the Queen. Her voice was gentle. It was the first voice he remembered. "Thank you for coming so fast and so bravely. But he has given in, and we must forgive him."
"It was shameful to murder my poor horse."
"We have made it up."
"If I had known you were going to make it up," said Lancelot rather jealously, "I would not have nearly killed myself in coming."
The Queen took his bare hand. The gauntlet was off. "Are you sorry?" she asked. "Because you have done so well?" He was silent. "I don't care about him," said the Queen, blushing. "I only thought it would be better not to have a scandal."
"I don't want a scandal any more than you do."
"You must do as you please," said the Queen. "Fight him if you like. You are the one to choose." Lancelot looked at her.
"Madam," he said, "so ye be pleased, I care not. As for my part, ye shall soon please."
He always fell into the grandeur of the high language when he was moved. Chapter 43. The wounded knights were laid on stretchers in the outer room. The inner room, where Guinevere slept, had a window with iron bars. There was no glass. Lancelot had noticed a ladder in the garden, which was long enough for his purpose, and although they had made no assignation, the Queen was waiting. When she saw his crumpled face at the window, with the inquisitive nose against the stars, she did not think it was a gargoyle or a demon. She stood for a few heartbeats, feeling the wild blood surge in her neck, then went silently to the window. The silence of an accomplice. Nobody knows what they said to each other. Malory says that they made either to other their complaints of many divers things. Probably they agreed that it was impossible to love Arthur and also to deceive him. Probably Lancelot made her understand about his God at last, and she made him understand about her missing children. Probably they fully agreed to accept their guilty love as ended. Later, Sir Lancelot whispered, "I wish I might come in."
"I would as fain."
"Would you, madam? With all your heart, that I were with you."
"Truly."
The last iron bar, as he broke it out, cut the brawn of his hand to the bone. Later still, the whispers faltered, and there was silence in the darkness of the room. Queen Guinevere lay long in bed next morning. Sir Meliagrance, anxious to get the whole affair safely ended as soon as possible, fussed in the antechamber, wishing she were gone. For one thing, he was not anxious to prolong his own torture by keeping the queen under his roof, whom he loved and could not have. At last, partly to hurry her off and partly out of a lover's uncontrollable curiosity, he went into the bedroom to wake her up, a proceeding which was possible in the days of the levee.
"Mercy," said Sir Meliagrance, "what ails you, ma'am, to sleep so long?"
He was looking at his lost beauty in the bed and pretending not to do so. The blood of Lancelot's cut hand was all over the sheets.
"Traitress!" cried Sir Meliagrance suddenly. "Traitress! You are a traitor to King Arthur!"
He was beside himself with rage and jealousy, believing himself deceived. He had been assuming, since his own enterprise had gone aglay, that the queen was a pure woman, and that he, in seeking to enjoy her, was in the wrong. Now he saw that all the time she had been cheating him, only pretending to be too virtuous to love him, and meanwhile sporting with her wounded knights under his very nose. He had jumped to the conclusion that the blood had come from a wounded knight. Otherwise, why should she have insisted on having them in the antechamber? The wildest envy was mixed with his rage. He never saw the bars of the window, which had been replaced as carefully as possible.
"Traitress! Traitress! I accuse you of high treason!"
The yells of Sir Meliagrance brought the hurt knights hobbling to the door. The commotion spread. Tire women and serving maids, pages, turf boys, a couple of grooms, all came with excitement to the scene.
"They are all false!" cried Sir Meliagrance. "All or some! A wounded knight hath been here!"
Guinevere said, "That is untrue. They can prove it."
"It is a lie," the knight shouted. "Choose which of us you will fight. We will fight you." "No, you won't," yelled Sir Meliagrance. "Away with your proud language. A wounded knight has been sleeping with Her Majesty."
And he kept on pointing to the blood, which was certainly good evidence, until Sir Lancelot arrived among the now sheepish bodyguard. Nobody noticed that his hand was in a glove.
"What is the matter?" asked Lancelot.
Meliagrance began telling him, wildly gesticulating, seizing with excitement upon a fresh person to tell. He was like a man crazy with grief. Lancelot said coldly,
"May I remind you about your own conduct towards the queen?"
"I don't know what you mean. I don't care. I know a knight was in this room last evening."
"Be careful what you say." Lancelot looked at him hard, trying to warn him and to bring him to his senses. They both knew that this accusation must end in trial by combat, and Lancelot wanted to make him realize with whom he would have to fight. Sir Meliagrance did realize this eventually. He looked at Lancelot with unexpected dignity.
"And you be careful too, Sir Lancelot," he said quietly. "I know you are the best knight in the world, but be careful how you fight in a wrong quarrel. God might strike a stroke for justice, Sir Lancelot, after all."
The queen's true lover set his teeth. "That must be left to God," he said. Then he added very meanly, "So far as I am concerned, I say plainly that none of these wounded knights was in the queen's room. And if you want to fight about it, I will fight you." Lancelot was, in the end, to fight for the queen at the stake three times. First in the good quarrel of Sir Mador, second in this very doubtful quibble of words with Sir Meliagrance, and third in a quarrel which was wrong altogether. And each fight brought them nearer to destruction. Sir Meliagrance threw down his glove. He was so certain of the truth of his assertion that he had become obstinate, as people do in violent arguments. He was prepared to die rather than withdraw. Lancelot took the glove. What else could he do? Everybody began attending to the paraphernalia of a challenge, the usual sealing of the gauges with signets and so on, and fixing of the date. Sir Meliagrance grew quieter. Now that he was caught in the machinery of justice, he had time to reflect, and as usual, his reflections went the opposite way. He was an inconsistent man.
"Sir Lancelot," he said, "now that we are fixed to have a fight, you won't do nothing treacherous to me meanwhile."
"Of course not." Lancelot looked at him in genuine amazement. His heart was like Arthur's. He was always getting himself into trouble, as for instance by unhorsing the Orkneys at Westminster, through underestimating the wickedness of the world.
"We will be friends till the battle."
The old warrior felt his long-accustomed pang of shame. He was to fight this man for saying what was practically true. "Yes," he said enthusiastically, "friends." He moved towards Meliagrance with an uprush of remorse.
"Then we will have peace for now," said Meliagrance in a pleased voice. "Everything above board. Would you like to see my castle?"
"Indeed, I should." Meliagrance led him all over the castle, from room to room, until they came to a chamber with a trap door. The board rolled and the trap opened. Lancelot fell 60 feet, landing on deep straw in a dungeon. Then Meliagrance ordered one of the horses to be hidden and went back to the queen to tell her that her champion had ridden ahead. Lancelot's well-known habit of abrupt departures lent colour to the story. It seemed to Meliagrance the best way of ensuring that God should not choose the wrong side of this quarrel, for Meliagrance was muddled with his standards too. Chapter 44. The second trial by combat was as sensational as the Mador one had been. For one thing, Lancelot arrived at the last moment by a still narrower margin. They had waited for him and given him up, and persuaded Sir Lavaine to fight in his place. Sir Lavaine was actually riding into the lists when the great man came at full gallop on a white horse, which belonged to Meliagrance. He had been held captive in the dungeon until that morning, when the girl who brought him his food had finally liberated him in the absence of her master, in exchange for a kiss. He had suffered some complicated scruples about this kiss, but had decided in the end that it was permissible. Meliagrance went down at the first charge and refused to get up.
"I yield," he said. "I'm a goner."
"Get up! Get up! You have not fought at all."
"I shan't," said Sir Meliagrance.
Lancelot stood over him in perplexity. He owed him a thrashing for the business of the horse and for the treachery of the trap door, but he knew that the man's accusation was essentially right, and he did not like the idea of killing him.
"Mercy," said Sir Meliagrance.
Lancelot turned his eyes sideways to the Queen's pavilion, where she sat under the constable's ward. Nobody could see this look of inquiry because of the great helm. Guinevere saw it, however, or felt it in her heart. She turned her thumb down over the edge of the box and secretly jabbed it downward several times. Meliagrance, she thought, was a dangerous man to keep alive. There was a great silence in the arena, while everybody waited without breath, leaning forward and looking upon the combatants like a circle of vultures whose prey is not yet dead. Everybody was waiting for the coup de grâce, like the people at a Roman amphitheatre or at a Spanish bullfight, and everybody was sure that Lancelot would give it. The accusation of Meliagrance had been, in their opinion, much more serious than the accusation of Mador, and they thought, like Guinevere, that he deserved to perish. For in those days, love was ruled by a different convention to ours. In those days it was chivalrous, adult, long, religious, almost platonic. It was not a matter about which you could make accusations lightly. It was not, as we take it to be nowadays, begun and ended in a long weekend. The spectators saw Lancelot hesitating over the man, and then heard his voice coming muffled by the helm. He was making proposals.
"I will give you odds,"
he was saying, "if you will get up and fight me properly to the death. I will take off my helm and all the armour on the left side of my body, and I will fight without a shield with my left hand tied behind my back. That will be fair, surely. Will you get up and fight me like that?" A sort of high, hysterical squeal came from Sir Meliagrance, who could be seen crawling towards the king's box and making violent gestures.
"Don't forget what he said," he was shouting. "Everybody heard him. I accept his terms. Don't let him go back on them. No armour for the left side, no shield or helm, and his left hand tied behind his back. Everybody heard? Everybody heard?"
The king cried, "Ho, and abide." The heralds and kings-at-arms came down the lists, and Meliagrance was silenced. Everybody felt shame on his behalf. In the distasteful stillness, while he muttered and insisted that the terms should be observed, reluctant hands disarmed Sir Lancelot and tied him. They felt they were helping at the execution of somebody whom they loved very much, for the odds were too heavy. When they had bound him and given him his sword, they patted him, pushing him forward towards Meliagrance with these rough pats and turning away their faces. There was a flash in the sandy lists, like a salmon jumping a weir. It was Lancelot showing his naked side to draw the blow, and as the blow came, there was the click of changing forms, the same click as comes in the kaleidoscope when the image alters. The blow which Meliagrance was giving had changed to a blow which Lancelot was giving. Sir Meliagrance was dragged out of the field by horses. His helm and head were in two pieces. Chapter 45. Well, that is the long story of how the foreigner from Benwick stole Queen Guinevere's love, of how he left her for his god, and finally returned, in spite of the taboo. It is a story of love in the old days, when adults loved faithfully, not a story of the present, in which adolescents pursue the ignoble spasms of the cinematograph. These people had struggled for a quarter of a century to reach their understanding, and now their Indian summer was before them. Lancelot had given his god to Guinevere, and she had given him his freedom in exchange. Elaine, who had never been more than an incidental part of the muddle, had achieved a peace of her own. Arthur, whose corner of the triangle was the least fortunate from a personal point of view, was not entirely wretched. Merlin had not intended him for private happiness. He had been made for royal joys, for the fortunes of a nation. These, for the time of their sunset, Lancelot's two sensational victories had restored. Fashion and modernity and the rot at the table's heart were in hiding, and his great idea was on the move once more. He was inventing law as power. Nor had Arthur cause for private reproach. He had kept himself aloof from the pains of Guinevere and Lancelot, unconsciously trusting them not to bring the matter to his consciousness, not from motives of fear or of weak connivance, but from the noblest of motives. The power had been in the king's hands. He had been in the position of a husband who could, by a single command, solve the problem of eternal triangles by reference to the headman's block or to the stake. His wife and her lover had been at his mercy. And that was the reason, not any reason of cowardice, why his generous heart had been determined to remain unconscious. The Indian summer was within their grasp. Gossip was silenced, discourtesy put down. The Orkney faction could only grumble, a distant and almost subterranean complaint. In the scriptoria of the abbeys, and in the castles of the great nobles, the harmless writers scribbled away at missals and treatises of knighthood, while the limners illuminated the capital letters and carefully drew blazons of arms. The goldsmiths and silversmiths hammered away with small hammers at gold leaf.
They twisted gold wire and inlaid interlacements of the wildest complexity on the croziers of the bishops. Pretty ladies kept robins and sparrows for pets, or tried very hard to teach their magpies to talk. Housewives of a provident turn of mind filled their cupboards with treacle as a medicine for bad air, and with homemade plasters called floss unguentorum for the rheumatics and musk balls to smell. They provided against Lent by purchasing dates and green ginger of almonds, and herrings at 4 shillings and 6 pence the horseload. Falconers and ostringers abused each other's hawks to their heart's content. In the new law courts, for Fort Main was over, the lawyers were as busy as bees, issuing writs for attainder, chancery, chevisance, disseisin, distraint, distress, embracery, exigent, fieri facias, maintenance, replevin, right of way, oyer and termina, scot and lot, quorum bonorum, sic et non, pro et contra, jus primae noctis, and questio quid juris. Thieves, it is true, could be hanged for stealing goods to the value of 1 shilling, for the codification of justice was still weak and muddled, but that was not so bad as it sounds, when you remember that for 1 shilling you could buy 2 geese, or 4 gallons of wine, or 48 loaves of bread, a troublesome load for a thief in any case. In the country lanes, the mere lovers, who were not gentles, walked in the sunsets with their arms round each other's waists, so that they gave the impression of a capital X when seen from behind. Arthur's Grammary was at peace, and the joys of peace stretched before Lancelot and Guinevere. But there was a fourth corner in the puzzle. God was Lancelot's totem. He was the other person of their battle, and now he chose the final moment to step across the path. The small boy who looked in the kettle hat and who dreamt of well water which always slipped away from his lips had cherished an ambition to do some ordinary miracle. He had managed a sort of miracle when he rescued Elaine from her tub by being the best knight in the world, before he was trapped by Elaine on that terrible evening so that he broke his taboo. For 25 years he had remembered the night with grief, and it had been with him through all the searches for the Grail. Before it, he had thought himself a man of God. Since then, he had been a swindle. Now the time had finally come to a head, when he was to be forced to face his doom. There was a knight from Hungary called Sir Jure, who had received wounds in a tournament 7 years before. He had been fighting with a man called Sir Alphegus, whom he had killed after getting these wounds, 3 of them on the head, 4 on the body, and on the left hand. The mother of the dead Alphegus had been a Spanish witch, and she had put an enchantment on Sir Jure of Hungary, so that none of the wounds could ever heal up. All the time they were to go on bleeding, turn about, until the best knight in the world had tended and salved them with his hands. Sir Jure of Hungary had long been carried from country to country, perhaps it was a sort of haemophilia, searching for the best knight who would be able to help him. At last he had braved the channel to reach this foreign northern land. Everybody had told him, everywhere, that his only chance was Lancelot, and in the end he had come to seek. Arthur, who always felt the best of everybody, was sure that Lance would be able to do it, but he thought it fair that every knight of the table should have a try. There might be a hidden excellence lurking somewhere, as had happened before. The court was at Carlisle at the time for the Feast of Pentecost, and it was arranged that everybody should meet in the town meadow. Sir Jure was carried there in a litter and laid on a cushion of gold cloth for the attempt at healing to begin. 110 knights, 40 were away on quests, stood round him in ordered ranks in their best clothes, and there were carpets laid down and pavilions set up for the great ladies to watch. Arthur loved his Lancelot so much that he wanted him to have a splendid setting in which his crowning achievement could be done. This is the end of the book of Sir Lancelot, and now we are to see him for the last time in it. He was hiding in the harness room of the castle, whence he could spy the field. There were plenty of leather reins in the room, hanging orderly among the saddles and the bright bits. He had noticed that they were strong enough to bear his weight. He was waiting there, hidden, praying that somebody, Gareth perhaps, would be able to do the miracle quickly, or if not, that they would overlook him, that his absence would not be noticed. Do you think it would be fine to be the best knight in the world? Think then also how you would have to defend the title. Think of the tests, such repeated, remorseless, scandal-breathing tests, which day after day would be applied to you, until the last and certain day when you would fail. Think also that you know of a good reason for your failure, which you have tried to hide, tried pathetically to hide and overlook for 25 years. Think that you are now to go out before the largest and most honourable gallery that can be assembled to make a public demonstration of your sin. They are expecting you to succeed, and you are to fail. You are to publish the deceit which you have practised for 25 years, and they will all immediately know the reason for it, that reason of shame which you have sought to conceal from your own mind, and which, when it has remembered itself in the silence of your empty chamber, has pricked you into a physical motion of your head to throw it off. Miracles, which you wanted to do so long ago, can only be done by the pure in heart. The people outside are waiting for you to do this miracle because you have traded on their belief that your heart was pure. And now, with treachery and adultery and murder wringing the heart like a cloth, you are to go out into the sunlight for the test of honour. Lancelot stood in the harness room as white as a sheet. Guinevere was out there, he knew, and she was also pale. He twisted his fingers and looked at the strong reins, and prayed as best he could.
"Sir Servaus Le Breuse!"
cried the heralds, and Sir Servaus stepped forward, a knight far down the list of competitors. He was a shy man, interested only in natural history, who had never fought with anybody in his life. He went over to Sir Ure, who was groaning from all the handling, and he knelt down and did his best.
"Sir Rosanna Le Cure Hardy!"
It went on like that, down the full list of 110 whose gorgeous names are given by Mallory in their proper order, so that you almost see the fine cut of their heavy brigandines, the tinctures of their blazons, and the gay colour in each panache. Their feathered heads made them look like Indian braves. The plates of their sabatons clinked as they walked, giving the firm, exciting ring of spurs. They knelt down, and Sir Ure winced, and it was no good. Lancelot did not hang himself with the reins. He had broken his taboo, deceived his friend, returned to Guinevere, and murdered Sir Meliagrance in a wrong quarrel. Now he was ready to take his punishment. He went to the long avenue of knights who waited in the sun. By the very attempt to evade notice, he had brought on himself the conspicuous place of last. He walked down the curious ranks, ugly as ever, self-conscious, ashamed, a veteran going to be broken. Mordred and Agravaine moved forward. When Lancelot was kneeling in front of Ure, he said to King Arthur, "Need I do this, after everybody has failed?" "Of course you must do it. I command you." "If you command me, I must. But it would be presumptuous to try, after everybody. Could I be let off?" "You are taking it the wrong way," said the king. "Of course it is not presumptuous for you to try. If you can't do it, nobody can." Sir Ure, who was weak by now, raised himself on an elbow.
"Please," he said. "I came for you to do it."
Lancelot had tears in his eyes. "Oh, Sir Eura," he said, "if only I could help you, how willingly I would. But you don't understand. You don't understand."
"For God's sake," said Sir Eura.
Lancelot looked into the east, where he thought God lived, and said something in his mind. It was more or less like this: "I don't want glory, but please, can you save our honesty? And if you will heal this knight for the knight's sake, please do." Then he asked Sir Eura to show him his head. Guinevere, who was watching from her pavilion like a hawk, saw the two men fumbling together. Then she saw a movement in the people near, and a mutter came, and yells. Gentlemen began throwing their caps about, and shouting, and shaking hands. Arthur was crying the same words again and again, holding gruff Gawain by the elbow and putting them into his ear. "It's shut like a box! It's shut like a box!" Some elderly knights were dancing around, banging their shields together, as if they were playing peas pudding hot and poking each other in the ribs. Many of the squires were laughing like madmen and slapping each other on the back. Sir Bors was kissing King Anguish of Ireland, who resented it. Sir Galahalt, the halt prince, had fallen over his scabbard. Generous Sir Bellaeus, who had borne no grudge for having his liver cut open on that distant evening beside the pavilion of Red Sendal, was making a horrible noise by blowing on a grass blade held edgewise between his thumbs. Sir Bedivere, frightfully repentant ever since his visit to the Pope, was rattling some holy bones which he had brought home as a souvenir of his pilgrimage. They had written on them in curly letters, "A present from Rome." Sir Bliant, remembering his gentle wild man, was embracing Sir Castor, who had never forgotten the Chevalier's knightly rebuke. Kind and sensitive Aglovale, the forgiver of the Pelennor feud, was exchanging hearty thumps with the beautiful Gareth. Mordred and Agravaine scowled. Sir Mador, as red as a turkey cock, was making it up with Sir Pinel the poisoner, who had come back incognito. King Pelles was promising a new cloak all round on him. The snow-haired Uncle Dap, so old as to be absolutely fabulous, was trying to jump over his walking stick. The tents were being let down, the banners waved. The cheers which now began round after round were like drum-fire or thunder rolling round the turrets of Carlisle. All the field and all the people in the field and all the towers of the castle seemed to be jumping up and down like the surface of a lake under rain. In the middle, quite forgotten, her lover was kneeling by himself. This lonely and motionless figure knew a secret which was hidden from the others. The miracle was that he had been allowed to do a miracle. And ever, says Malory, Sir Lancelot wept, as he had been a child that had been beaten. Explicit liber tertius. Incipit liber quartus. The candle in the wind. He thought a little and said, "I have found the zoological gardens of service to many of my patients. I should prescribe for Mr. Pontifex a course of the larger mammals. Don't let him think he is taking them medicinally." Chapter 1. The addition of years had not been kind to Agravaine. Even when he was 40, he had looked his present age, which was 55. He was seldom sober. Mordred, the cold wisp of a man, did not seem to have any age. His years, like the depths of his blue eyes and the inflections of his musical voice, were non-committal. The two were standing in the cloisters of the Orkney Palace at Camelot, looking out at the hawks who sat beneath the sun on their blocks in the green courtyard. The cloisters had the new-fashioned flamboyant arches, in whose graceful frames the hawks stood out with noble indifference. A gerfalcon, a goshawk, a falcon and her tiercel, and four little merlins who had been kept all winter yet had survived. The blocks were clean, for the sportsmen of those days considered that if you went in for blood sports, it was your duty to conceal the beastliness with scrupulous care. All were lovingly ornamented with Spanish leather in scarlet and with gold tooling. The leashes of the hawks were plaited out of white horse leather. The jer had a snow-white leash and jesses cut from guaranteed unicorn skin as a tribute to her station in life. She had been brought all the way from Iceland, and that was the least they could do for her. Mordred said pleasantly, "For God's sake, let's get out of this. The place stinks." When he spoke, the hawks moved slightly, so that their bells gave a whisper of sound. The bells had been brought from the Indies, regardless of expense, and the pair worn by the jer were made of silver. An enormous eagle owl, who was sometimes used as a decoy, but who was at present standing on a perch in the shade of the cloister, opened his eyes when the bells rang. Before he had opened them, he might have been a stuffed owl, a dowdy bundle of feathers. The moment they had dawned, he was a creature from Edgar Allan Poe. You hardly liked to look at him. They were red eyes, homicidal, terrific, seeming actually to give out light. They were like rubies filled with flame. He was called the Grand Duke. "I don't smell anything," said Agravaine. He sniffed suspiciously, trying to smell. But his palate was gone, both for smell and taste, and he had a headache. "It stinks of sport," said Mordred, in inverted commas, "and the done thing, and the best people. Let's go to the garden." Agravaine returned tenaciously to the subject which they had been discussing.
"It's no good making a fuss about it," he said. "We know the rights and wrongs, but nobody else knows. Nobody would listen."
"But they must listen." Small flecks in the iris of Mordred's eyes burned with a turquoise light, as bright as the owl's. Instead of being a foppish man with a crooked shoulder dressed in extravagant clothes, he became a cause. He became, on this matter, everything which Arthur was not, the irreconcilable opposite of the Englishman. He became the invincible Gael, the scion of desperate races more ancient than Arthur's and more subtle. Now, when he was on fire with his cause, Arthur's justice seemed bourgeois and obtuse beside him. It seemed merely to be dull complacency beside the savagery and feral wit of the Pict. His maternal ancestors crowded into his face when he was spurning at Arthur, ancestors whose civilization, like Mordred's, had been matriarchal, who had ridden bare-back, charged in chariots, fought by stratagem, and ornamented their grisly strongholds with the heads of enemies. They had marched, long-haired and ferocious, an ancient writer tells us, sword in hand, against rivers in flood or against the storm-tossed ocean. They were the race now represented by the Irish Republican Army rather than by the Scots Nationalists, who had always murdered landlords and blamed them for being murdered. The race which could make a national hero of a man like Lynch-Owen because he bit off a woman's nose and she a Gaul. The race which had been expelled by the volcano of history into the far quarters of the globe, where, with a venomous sense of grievance and inferiority, they even nowadays proclaim their ancient megalomania. They were the Catholics, who could fly directly in the face of any pope or saint, Adrian, Alexander, or St. Jerome, if the saint's policies did not suit their own convenience. The hysterically touchy, sorrowful, flayed defenders of a broken heritage. They were the race whose barbarous, cunning, valiant defiance had been enslaved, long centuries before, by the foreign people whom Arthur represented. This was one of the barriers between the father and his son. Agravain said,
"Mordred, I want to talk. There doesn't seem to be anywhere to sit. Sit on that thing, and I will sit here. Nobody can hear us."
"I don't mind if they do hear. That is what we want. It should be said out loud, not whispered in cloisters."
"The whispers will get there in the end."
"No, they won't. That is what they won't do. He doesn't want to hear. And so long as we whisper, he can always pretend that he can't. You are not the King of England for all these years without knowing how to use hypocrisy." Agravain was uncomfortable. His hatred for the king was not a reality like Mordred's. Indeed, he had little personal feeling against anybody except Lancelot. His attitude was more of malice at random.
"I don't think it is any good complaining about what has happened in the past," he said gloomily. "We can't expect other people to side with us when everything is complicated and happened so long ago."
"It may have happened long ago, but that doesn't alter the fact that Arthur is my father and that he turned me adrift in a boat as a baby."
"It may not alter it for you," said Agravain, "but it alters it for other people. It is such a muddle that nobody cares. You can't expect ordinary people to remember about grandfathers and half-sisters and things of that sort. In any case, human beings don't go to war for private quarrels nowadays. You need a national grievance, something to do with politics, which is waiting to burst out. You need to use the tools which are ready to hand. This man John Ball, for instance, who believes in communism, he has thousands of followers who would be ready to help in a disturbance for their own purposes. Oh, there are the Saxons. We could say we were in favour of a national movement. For that matter, we could join them together and call it national communism. But it has to be something broad and popular, which everybody can feel. It must be against large numbers of people, like the Jews or the Normans or the Saxons, so that everybody can be angry. Either we must be the leaders of the old ones who seek for justice against the Saxon, or of the Saxon against the Norman, or of the serf against society. We want a banner, yes, and a badge, too. You could use the Philfort. Communism, nationalism, something like that. But as for a private grudge against the old man, it's useless. Anyway, it would take you half an hour to explain it, even if you did begin to shout it from the rooftops."
"I could shout that my mother was his sister, and that he tried to drown me because of that."
"If you wanted to," said Agravain.
They had been talking, before the Eagle Owl woke up, about the earlier wrongs of their family, about their grandmother, Igraine, who had been wronged by Arthur's father, about all the long-gone feud of Gael and Gaul, which had been taught them by their dam in old Dunlothian. It was these wrongs which Agravain's colder blood could recognise as far too distant and confused to serve as weapons against the king. Now they had reached the more recent grievance, the sin of Arthur with his half-sister, which had ended in an attempt to murder the bastard who resulted. These might certainly be stronger weapons, but the trouble was that Mordred was himself the bastard. The elder brother's cowardice told him, in his craftier head, that a son could hardly raise his illegitimacy as a banner under which to overthrow his father. Besides, the business had been hushed up long before by Arthur. It seemed bad policy that Mordred should be the one to bring it up. They sat in silence, looking at the floor. Agravain was out of condition, with pouches under his eyes. Mordred was as slim as ever, a neat figure in the height of fashion. The exaggeration of his dress made a good camouflage for him, under which you hardly noticed his crooked shoulder. He said,
"I am not proud."
He looked bitterly at his half-brother, putting more meaning into the look than the other could be expected to catch. he was saying with his eyes, "Look at my hump, then. I have no reason to be proud of my birth." Agravaine got up impatiently. "I must have a drink in any case," he said, clapping his hands for the page. Then he passed his trembling fingers over his eyelids and stood wearily, looking at the owl with distaste. Mordred, while they were waiting for the drink, watched him with contempt. "If you rake the old muck," said Agravaine, revived by the Hippocras, "you will get yourself in the muck. We're not in Lothian, you must remember. We're in Arthur's England, and his English love him. Either they will refuse to believe you, or if they do believe you, they will blame you and not him, because it was you who brought the matter up. It is certain that not a single man would follow a rebellion of that sort." Mordred looked at him. He was hating him like the owl, condemning him as a coward. He could not bear to be thwarted in his daydream of revenge, so he was wreaking his spite on Agravaine in his thoughts, saying to himself that the latter was a drunken traitor to the family. Agravaine saw this, and already consoled by half the bottle, laughed in his face. He patted the good shoulder, forcing the younger man to fill his glass. "Drink!" he said, chuckling. Mordred drank like a cat being dosed. "Have you heard?" asked Agravaine waggishly. "Of a mighty saint called Lancelot." He winked one of the pouchy eyes, looking down his nose with benevolence. "Go on." "I gather you have heard about our preux chevalier." "I know Sir Lancelot, of course. I think I'm not wrong in saying that this pure gentleman has given both of us a fall or two." "The first time Lancelot unhorsed me," said Mordred, "is so long ago that I can't remember, but it means nothing. Because a man can push you off a horse with a stick, it doesn't mean that he is a better man than you are." It was a strange feature, now that Lancelot was in the conversation, that Mordred's vivid feeling was exchanged for indifference. But Agravaine, who had been reluctant before this, became fluent.
"Precisely," he said, "and our noble knight has been the Queen of England's lover all the time. Everybody knows that Gwen has been Lancelot's mistress since before the deluge, but what good is that? The king knows it himself. He has been told so 3 times, to my certain knowledge. I don't see that we can do anything." Agravaine put his finger by the side of his nose like a drunken piper, then shook it at his brother. "He has been told so," he announced, "but in roundabout ways. People have sent him hints, such as shields with cognizances on them that had double meanings, or horns which only faithful wives could drink from. But nobody has told him about it in open court, face to face. Meliagrance only made a general accusation, and even that was in the days of trial by battle. Think what would happen if we were to denounce Sir Lancelot personally, under these new-fashioned laws, so that the king was forced to investigate."
Mordred's eyes dawned, as the owl's had done.
"Well, I can't see that anything could happen except a split. Arthur depends on Lancelot as his commander, and the chief of his troops. That is where his power comes from, because everybody knows that nobody can stand against brute force. But if we could make a little merry mischief between Arthur and Lancelot because of the queen, their power would be split. Then would be the time for policy. Then would be the time for discontented people, Lollards and communists and nationalists and all the riffraff. Then would be the time to take your famous revenge."
"We could break them up, because they were broken among themselves."
"But it means more than that.
It means that the Cornwalls would be even for grandfather and I for mother. not by using force against force, but by using our brains. It means that I could revenge myself on the man who tried to drown me as a baby. By getting behind the bully first, and then by being a little careful. Behind our famous double blue, Sir Lancelot.
The position was, and perhaps it may as well be laboured for the last time, that Arthur's father had killed the Earl of Cornwall. He had killed the man because he wanted to enjoy the wife. On the night of the Earl's killing, Arthur had been conceived upon the unfortunate Countess. Being born too soon for the various conventions of mourning, marriage, and so forth, he had been secretly put to nurse with Sir Ector of the Forest Sauvage. He had grown up in ignorance of his parentage, until, when he was a young boy of 19 summers, he had fallen in with Morgause, without knowing that she was one of his half-sisters, by the Countess and the slaughtered Earl. This half-sister, already the mother of Gawain, Agravaine, Gaheris, and Gareth, had been twice the age of the young king, and she had successfully seduced him. The offspring of their union had been Mordred, who had been brought up alone with his mother in the barbarous remoteness of the Outer Isles. He had been brought up alone with Morgause because he was so much younger than the rest of the family. The others had already flown to the king's court, forced there by ambition because it was the greatest court in the world, or else to escape their mother. Mordred had been left to be dominated by her, with her ancestral grudge against the king and her personal spite. For although she had contrived to seduce young Arthur in his nonage, he had escaped her, to settle down with Guinevere as his wife. Morgause, brooding in the north with the one child who remained to her, had concentrated her maternal powers on the crooked boy. She had loved and forgotten him by turns, an insatiable carnivore who lived on the affections of her dogs, her children, and her lovers. Eventually, one of the other sons had cut her head off in a storm of jealousy, on discovering her in bed at the age of 70 with a young man called Sir Lamorack. Mordred, confused between the loves and hatreds of his frightful home, had at the time been a party to her assassination. Now, in the court of a father who had been considerate enough to hide the story of his birth, the wretched son found himself the acknowledged brother of Gawain, Agravaine, Gaheris, and Gareth, found himself lovingly treated by the king father whom his mother had taught him to hate with all his heart, found himself misshapen, intelligent, critical, in a civilization which was too straightforward for purely intellectual criticism, found himself, finally, the heir to a northern culture which has always been antagonistic to the blunt morals of the south. Chapter 2. The page who had brought Sir Agravaine's Hippocras came in from the cloister door. He bowed double, with the exaggerated courtesy which was expected of pages before they became esquires on their way to knighthood, and announced, "Sir Gawain, Sir Gaheris, Sir Gareth." The three brothers followed him, boisterous from the open air and their recent doings, so that now the clan was complete. All of them, except Mordred, had wives of their own tucked away somewhere, but nobody ever saw them. Few saw the men themselves separate for long. There was something childish about them when they were together, which was attractive, rather than the reverse. Perhaps there was something childish about all the paladins of Arthur's story, if being simple is the same as childishness. Gawain, who was the head of the family, walked first, with a falcon in juvenile plumage on his fist. The burly fellow had pale hairs in his red head now. Over the ears it was yellowish, the colour of a ferret's, and would soon be white. Gaheris looked like him, or at least he was more like him than the others, but he was a milder copy, not so red, nor so strong, nor so big, nor so obstinate. Indeed, he was a bit of a fool. Gareth, the youngest of the brothers, had retained the traces of his youth. He walked with a spring in his step, as though he enjoyed being alive.
"Tuts!" exclaimed Gawain's hoarse voice in the doorway. "Drinking already?"
He still kept his outland accent in defiance of the mere English, but he had ceased to think in Gaelic. His English had improved against his will. He was getting old.
"Well, Gawain, well?"
Agravain, who knew that his nips before noon were disapproved of, asked politely, "Did you have a good day?"
"It wasna bad."
"It was a splendid day," exclaimed Gareth. "We entered her on the Haute Volée with Lancelot's passager, and she was genuinely grey-minded. I never thought she would take to it without a bagman. Gawain had managed her perfectly. She dropped into it without a second's hesitation, as if she had never been flying to anything but the Heron. Took a fine circle right round the new ricks by Castle Blank, and got above him just to the Gannis side of the Pilgrim's Way. She..." Gawain, who had noticed that Mordred was yawning on purpose, said,
"Ye may spare your breath."
"It was a fine flight," he concluded lamely. "As she'd handled her quarry, we thought we could give her a name."
"What did you call her?"
they asked condescendingly. "Since she comes from Lundy, and begins with an L, we thought it might be a good idea to call her after Lancelot. We could call her Lancelotta, or something like that. She will be a first-class falcon." Agravain looked at Gareth under the lids of his eyes. He said with a slow tone,
"Then you'd better call her Gwen."
Gawain came back from the courtyard where he had been putting the peregrine on her block.
"Leave that," he said.
"I'm sorry if I'm not suggesting the truth."
"I care naught about the truth or not. All I say is, hold your tongue."
"Gawain," said Mordred to the heir, "is such a preux chevalier that nobody must say anything wicked or there will be trouble. You see, he is strong, and he apes the great Sir Lancelot."
The red fellow turned on him with dignity.
"I'm na muckle strong, brother, and I dinna trade upon it. I only seek to keep my people decent."
"And of course," said Agravain, "it is decent to sleep with the king's wife, even if the king's family has smashed our family and got a son by our mother and tried to drown him."
Gaheris protested.
"Arthur has always been good to us. Do stop this whining for once."
"Because he is afraid of us."
"I don't see," said Gareth, "why Arthur should be afraid when he has Lancelot. We all know that he is the best knight in the world and can master anybody. Don't we, Gawain?"
"For myself, I dinna wish to speak of it."
Suddenly, Mordred was flaming at them, fired by Gawain's lordly tone.
"Very well, and I do. I may be a weak knight at jousting, but I have the courage to stand for my family and rights. I'm not a hypocrite. Everybody in this court knows that the Queen and the Commander-in-Chief are lovers, and yet we're supposed to be pure knights and protectors of ladies, and nobody talks about anything except this so-called Holy Grail. Agravain and I have decided to go to Arthur now, in full court, and ask about the Queen and Lancelot to his face."
"Mordred," exclaimed the head of the clan, "you will do nothing of the like. It will be sinful."
"He will," said Agravain. "And I shall go there with him."
Gareth remained between pain and amazement.
"But they mean it," he protested.
Out of the moment of astonishment, Gawain took the lead and forged into action.
"Agravain, I am the head of the clan, and I forbid ye."
"You forbid me?"
"Yes, I do forbid ye, for ye will be a sair fool if ye do."
"The honest Gawain," remarked Mordred, "thinks you are a sair fool."
This time the towering fellow swung on him like a shying horse.
"None of that,"
he shouted.
"Ye think I will na hit ye, because ye're crooked, and ye take advantage, but I will hit ye, Manny, if ye sneer."
Mordred heard his own voice speaking coldly, seeming to come from behind his ears.
"Gawain, you surprise me. You have produced a sequence of thought."
Then, as the giant came towards him, the same voice said,
"Go on, strike me. It will show your courage."
"Ah, do stop, Mordred," pleaded Gareth. "Can't you stop this nagging for a minute?"
"Mordred wouldn't nag, as you call it," interjected Agravaine, "if you didn't bully."
Gawain exploded like one of the new-fashioned cannons. He swung away from Mordred, a baited bull, and shouted at them both,
"My soul to the devil! Will ye be quiet or will ye clear out? Can we have no peace in the family ever? Shut your trap in the name of God, and leave this daft clatter about Sir Lancelot."
"It is not daft," said Mordred, "nor shall we leave it."
He stood up.
"Well, Agravaine," he asked,
"do we go to the king? Is any other coming?"
Gawain planted himself in their path.
"Mordred, ye shall no go."
"Who is to stop me?"
"I am."
"Brave fellow,"
remarked the icy voice, still from somewhere in the air, and the humpback moved to pass. Gawain put out his red hand, with golden hairs on the back of the fingers, and pushed him back. At the same time, Agravaine put out his own white hand, with fat fingers, to the hilt of his sword.
"Don't move, Gawain! I have a sword!"
"You would have a sword!" cried Gareth. "You devil!"
The younger brother's life had suddenly fitted into a pattern and recognized itself. Their murdered mother, and the unicorn, and the man now drawing, and a child in a storeroom flashing a dirk, these things had made him cry out.
"All right, Gareth," snarled Agravaine, as white as a sheet. "I know what you mean, and now I draw."
The situation passed out of control. They began acting like puppets, as if it had happened before, which it had. Gawain, at the sight of steel, went into one of his blind rages. He swung away from Mordred, burst into a torrent of words, drew the hunting knife, which was all he carried, and advanced on Agravaine, these things simultaneously. The fat man, as if thrown back on the defensive by the impact of his brother's fury, retreated before him, holding the sword in front with shaking hand.
"Aye!" roared Gawain. "Ye ken fine what he means, my bonny butcher. Ye maun draw on your ain brother, for ye ever speared to murder folk unarmed. The curse of the gravecloth on ye! Put up yon sword, man, put it up! What do ye mean? Is it nae enough that ye should slay our mother? Damn ye, lay down yon sword, or I hae the spunk to fight with it! Agravaine!"
Mordred was slipping behind his back, with a hand on his own dagger. In a second the glint of steel flashed in the shadows, lit by the owl's eyes, and at the same moment Gareth jumped to the defence. He caught Mordred by the wrist, crying,
"Now, enough! Gaheris, look to the others! Agravaine, put the sword up! Gawain, leave him alone!" "Away, man! I can teach the hound myself! Agravaine, put the sword down quickly, or he will kill you. Be quick, man, don't be a fool. Gawain, leave him alone. He didn't mean it. Gawain, Agravaine!"
But Agravaine had made a feeble thrust at the head of the family, which Gawain turned contemptuously with his knife. Now the towering old fellow with the ferret-coloured temples had rushed in and pinned him round the waist. The sword clattered to the floor as Agravaine went backward over the hippocras table with Gawain on top of him. The dagger rose in venom to complete the work, but Gaheris caught it from behind. There was a tableau of perfect silence, all motionless. Gareth held Mordred. Agravaine, hiding his eyes with a free hand, flinched from the knife, and Gaheris held the avenging arm suspended. At this complicated moment, the cloistered door was opened for the second time, and the courteous page announced as impassively as ever,
His Majesty the King.
Everybody relaxed. They let go of whatever they were holding and began to move. Agravain sat up, panting. Gawain turned away from him, drawing a hand across his face.
Ah, God, he muttered, if but I hadn't a sick-like wayful passions.
The king was on the threshold. He came in, the quiet old man who had done his best so long. He looked older than his age, which was considerable. His royal eye took in the situation without a flicker. He moved across the cloister to kiss Mordred gently, smiling upon them all. Chapter 3 Lancelot and Guinevere were sitting at the solar window. An observer of the present day, who knew the Arthurian legend only from Tennyson and people of that sort, would have been startled to see that the famous lovers were past their prime. We who have learned to base our interpretation of love on the conventional boy and girl romance of Romeo and Juliet would be amazed if we could step back into the Middle Ages, when the poet of chivalry could write about man that he had en ciel un dieu, par terre une déesse. Lovers were not recruited then among the juveniles and adolescents. They were seasoned people who knew what they were about. In those days, people loved each other for their lives, without the conveniences of the divorce court and the psychiatrist. They had a god in heaven and a goddess on earth. And since people who devote themselves to goddesses must exercise some caution about the ones to whom they are devoted, they neither chose them by the passing standards of the flesh alone, nor abandoned it lightly when the bruckle thing began to fail. Lancelot and Guinevere were sitting by the window in the high keep, and Arthur's England stretched below them, under the level rays of sunset. It was the gramarye of the Middle Ages, which some people are accustomed to think of as the Dark Ages, and Arthur had made it what it was. When the old king came to his throne, it had been an England of armoured barons and of famine and of war. It had been the country of trial by ordeal with red-hot irons, of the law of Englishry, and of the sad, wordless song of Morva Rithlan. Then, on the sea coast, within a foreign vessel's reach, not an animal, not a fruit tree had been left. Then, in the fens and the vast forests, the last of the Saxons had defended themselves against the bitter rule of Uther the Conqueror. Then the words Norman and Baron had been equivalent to the modern world of Sahib. Then Llewellyn ap Griffith's head, in its crown of ivy, had mouldered on the clustered spikes of the tower. Then you would have met the mendicants by the roadside, mutilated men who carried their right hands in their left, and the forest dogs would have trotted beside them, also mutilated by the removal of one toe, so that they could not hunt in the woodlands of the Lord. When Arthur first came, the country people had been accustomed to bar themselves in their cottages every night, as if for siege, and had prayed to God for peace during darkness, the goodman of the house repeating the prayers used at sea on the approach of storm, and ending with the plea, "The Lord bless and help us," to which all present had replied, "Amen." In the baron's castle in the early days, you would have found the poor men being disemboweled and their living bowels burned before them, men being slit open to see if they had swallowed their gold, men gagged with notched iron bits, men hanging upside down with their heads in smoke, others in snake pits or with leather tourniquets round their heads, or crammed into stone-filled boxes which would break their bones. You have only to turn to the literature of the period, with its stories of the mythological families such as Plantagenets, Capets, and so forth, to see how the land lay. Legendary kings like John had been accustomed to hang 28 hostages before dinner, or like Philip had been defended by sergeants at mace, a kind of storm troopers who guarded their lord with maces, or like Louis, had decapitated their enemies on scaffolds under the blood of which the children of the enemy had been forced to stand. This, at all events, is what Ingulf of Croyland used to tell us, until he was discovered to be a forgery. Then there had been archbishops, nicknamed Skin Villain, and churches used as forts, with trenches in the graveyards among the bones, and price lists for fining murderers, and bodies of the excommunicated lying unburied, and famishing peasants eating grass or tree bark, or one another. One of them ate 48. There had been roasting heretics on the one hand. 45 Templars had been burnt in one day, and the heads of captives being thrown into besieged castles from catapults on the other. Here a leader of the Jacquerie had been writhing in his chains as he was crowned with a red-hot tripod. There a pope had been complaining as he was held to ransom, or another one had been wriggling as he was poisoned. Treasure had been cemented into castle walls in the form of gold bars, and the builders had been executed afterwards. Children playing in the streets of Paris had frolicked with the dead body of a constable, and others, with the women and old men, had starved outside the walls of beleaguered towns, yet inside the ring of the besiegers. Hus and Jerome, with the mitres of apostasy upon their heads, had flamed and fizzled at the stake. The hamstrung imbeciles of Jumièges had floated down the Seine. Gilles de Retz had been found to have no less than a ton of children's bones calcined in his castle, after having murdered them at the rate of 70 a year for 9 years. The Duke of Berry had lost a kingdom through the unpopularity which he earned by feeling sorry for 800 foot soldiers who had been killed in a battle. The youthful Count of St. Pol had been taught the arts of war by being given 24 living prisoners to slaughter in various ways for practice. Louis XI, another of the fictional kings, had kept obnoxious bishops in rather expensive cages. The Duke Robert had been surnamed the Magnificent by his nobles, but the Devil by his parishioners. And all the while, before Arthur came, the common people, of whom 14 were eaten by wolves out of one town in a single week, of whom 1/3 were to die in the Black Death, of whom the corpses had been packed in pits like bacon, for whom the refuges at evening had often been forests and marshes and caves, for whom in 70 years there had been known to be 48 of famine. These people had looked up at the feudal nobility, who were termed the lords of sky and earth, and, themselves battered by bishops who, because they were not allowed to shed blood, went for them with iron clubs, had cried aloud that Christ and his saints were sleeping. Pourquoi, the poor wretches had sung in their misery, pourquoi nous laisser faire dommage, nous sommes hommes comme ils sont. Such had been the surprisingly modern civilization which Arthur had inherited. But it was not the civilization over which the lovers looked out. Now, safe in the apple-green sunset before them, there stretched the fabled Merry England of the Middle Ages, when they were not so dark. Lancelot and Guinevere were gazing on the Age of Individuals. What an amazing time the Age of Chivalry was! Everybody was essentially himself, was riotously busy fulfilling the vagaries of human nature. There was such a gusto about the landscape which stretched before their window, such a riot of unexpected people and things, that you hardly knew how to begin describing it. The Dark and Middle Ages. The 19th century had an impudent way with its labels, for there, under the window in Arthur's grammary, the sun's rays flamed from 100 jewels of stained glass in monasteries and convents, or danced from the pinnacles of cathedrals and castles which their builders had actually loved. Architecture, in those dark ages of theirs, was such a light-giving passion of the heart that men gave love names to their fortresses. Lancelot's joyous guard was not a singularity in an age which has left us beauté, plaisance, or malvoisin. the bad neighbour to its enemies, an age in which even an oaf like the imaginary Richard Coeur de Lion, who suffered from boils, could call his castle Gaillard, and speak of it as my beautiful one-year-old daughter. Even that legendary scoundrel William the Conqueror had a second nickname, the Great Builder. Think of the glass itself, with its five grand colours stained right through. It was rougher than ours, thicker, fitted in smaller pieces. They loved it with the same fury as they gave to their castles, and Villard de Honnecourt, struck by a particularly beautiful specimen, stopped to draw it on his journeys with the explanation that I was on my way to obey a call to the land of Hungary when I drew this window, because it pleased me best of all windows. Picture the insides of those ancient churches, not the grey and gutted interiors to which we are accustomed, but insides blazing with colour, plastered with frescoes in which all the figures stood on tiptoe, fluttering with tapestry or with brocades from Baghdad. Picture also the interiors of such castles as were visible from Guinevere's window. These were no longer the grim keeps of Arthur's accession. Now they were filling with furniture made by the joiner instead of the carpenter. Now their walls rippled doorless with flexible gaieties of Arras, tapestries like that of the jousts of Saint-Denis, which, although covering more than 400 square yards, had been woven in less than 3 years. Such was the ardour of its creation. If you look closely in a ruined castle, even nowadays, you can sometimes find the hooks from which these flashing tapestries were hung. Remember, too, the goldsmiths of Lorraine, who made shrines in the shape of little churches, with aisles, statues, transepts and all, like dolls' houses. Remember the enamellers of Limoges, and the Champlevé work, and the German ivory carvers, and the garnets set in Irish metal. Finally, if you're willing to picture the ferment of creative art which existed in our famous ages of darkness, you must get rid of the idea that written culture came to Europe with the fall of Constantinople. Every clerk in every country was a man of culture in those days. It was his profession to be so. "Every letter written," said a medieval abbot, "is a wound inflicted on the devil." The library of Saint-Piquier, as early as the 9th century, had 256 volumes, including Virgil, Cicero, Terence, and Macrobius. Charles V had no less than 910 volumes, so that his personal collection was about as big as the Everyman Library is today. Lastly, there were, under the windows, the people themselves, the coruscating mixture of oddities who reckoned that they possessed the things called souls as well as bodies, and who fulfilled them in the most surprising ways. In Sylvester II, a famous magician ascended the papal throne, although he was notorious for having invented the pendulum clock. A fabled king of France called Robert, who had suffered the misfortune to be excommunicated, ran into dreadful troubles about his domestic arrangements, because the only two servants who could be persuaded to cook for him insisted on burning the saucepans after meals. An Archbishop of Canterbury, having excommunicated all the prebendaries of St. Paul's in a pet, rushed into the priory of St. Bartholomew and knocked out the sub-prior in the middle of the chapel, which created such an uproar that his own vestments were torn off, revealing a suit of armour underneath, and he had to flee to Lambeth in a boat. The Countess of Anjou always used to vanish out of the window at the secreta of the mass. Madame Trotte de Salerno used her ears as a handkerchief and let her eyebrows hang down behind her shoulders like silver chains. A bishop of Bath, under the imaginary Edward I, was considered, after due reflection, to be an unsuitable man for the archbishopric, because he had too many illegitimate children. Not some, but too many. And the bishop himself could hardly hold a candle to the Countess of Henneberge, who suddenly gave birth to 365 children at one confinement. It was the age of fullness, the age of wading into everything up to the neck. Perhaps Arthur imposed this ideal on Christendom because of the richness of his own schooling under Merlin. For the king, or at least this is how Malory interprets him, was the patron saint of chivalry. He was not a distressed Briton hopping about in a suit of woad in the 5th century, nor yet one of those nouveaux riches de la pole who must have afflicted the last years of Malory himself. Arthur was the heart's king of a chivalry which had reached its flower perhaps 200 years before our antiquarian author began to work. He was the badge of everything that was good in the Middle Ages, and he had made these things himself. As Malory pictures him, Arthur of England was the champion of a civilization which is misrepresented in the history books. The serf of chivalry was not a slave for whom there was no hope. On the contrary, he had at least 3 legitimate ways of rising, the greatest of which was the Catholic Church. With the assistance of Arthur's policies, this church, still the greatest of all corporations free to learned men on earth, had become a highway open to the lowest slave. A Saxon peasant was pope in Adrian IV, the son of a carpenter in Gregory VII. In those despised Middle Ages of theirs, you could become the greatest man in the world by simply having learning. And it is a mistake to believe that Arthur's civilization was weak in this famous science of ours. The scientists, although they happened to call them magicians at the time, invented almost as terrible things as we have invented, except that we have become accustomed to theirs by use. The greatest magicians, like Albertus Magnus, Friar Bacon, and Raymond Lully, knew several secrets which we have lost today, and discovered as a side issue what still appears to be the chief commodity of civilization, namely gunpowder. They were honoured for their learning, and Albert the Great was made a bishop. One of them, who was called Baptista Porta, seems to have invented the cinema, though he sensibly decided not to develop it. As for aircraft, in the 10th century, a monk called Ethelmer was experimenting with them and might have succeeded, but for an accident in adjusting of his tail unit. He crashed, quod, says William of Malmesbury, caudem in posteriori parte oblitus fuerat adaptare. Even in modernity, the ages of darkness were not so far behind us. At least they had some sparkling names for their fiercer cocktails, which they called Huff the Cap, Mad Dog, Father Horsonne, Angel's Food, Dragon's Milke, Go to the Wall, Stride Wide, and Lift Leg. The view from the window was delightful, though in some cases it was odd. Where we have hedged fields and parklands, they had village communities, moorlands, fens, and forests of enormous size. Sherwood stretched for hundreds of miles, from Nottingham to the middle of York. The busyness that went on in the island, the beekeeping and the rook-scaring and the ploughing with oxen, for these you must look in the Luttrell Psalter, where they are beautifully drawn. In those days, if you'd been interested by peculiar things, perhaps you would have had the luck to notice a knight in armour riding past the window. You would have noticed his head, which was shaved round the ears and at the back, but on the top of his head his hair rose up like a Japanese doll's, so that the skull looked like a cottage loaf. This topknot made an excellent shock absorber under his helm. The next man to pass might have been a clerk, perhaps on an ambler, and the hair of this one would have been exactly the opposite of the knight's, for he would have been completely bald on top, because of his tonsure. When he had gone to the bishop to be made a clerk in the first place, he had taken a pair of scissors with him. Next, if you wanted some peculiar person to ride by, there might have come a crusader who had promised to deliver the grace of God. You would have expected the cross on his surcoat, no doubt, But you might not have realized that he was so delighted with the whole affair that he put the same symbol almost everywhere that it could be made to go. Like a new Boy Scout, transported with enthusiasm, he would have stuck the cross on his escutcheon, on his coat, on his helm, on his saddle, and on the horse's curb. The next man to pass the window might have been one sort of Cistercian lay brother, whom you would have expected to be a learned man because of his cloth. But no, he was ex officio an illiterate. It was his business to stick the leaden seals on papal bulls, and so as to preserve the secrecy of the Pope, they used to make sure that he could not read a word. Now might come a Saxon, wearing the beard and a sort of Phrygian cap as a sign of defiance, now a knight from the marches of the northern border. The latter, because he lived by raiding during the night time, would have borne a moon and stars on azure in his coat. Here might be some smoke in the landscape, rising from the bellows of an alchemist, who was, most sensibly, trying to turn lead into gold, an art which has remained beyond us to the present day, though we are getting nearer to it with atomic fusion. There, far away in the environs of a monastery, you might have seen a procession of angry monks making a barefoot march round their foundation, but they might have been walking against the sun in malediction, because they had fallen out with the abbot. Perhaps if you looked in this direction, you would see a vineyard fenced with bones. It had been discovered during the early years of Arthur that bones made an excellent fence for vineyards, graveyards, or even for forts. And perhaps, if you looked in the other, you would see a castle door that looked like a keeper's gallows. It would have been completely covered with the nailed heads of wolves, bears, stags, and so forth. Far away, over there to the left, perhaps, there would be a tournament going on according to the laws laid down by Geoffrey de Pruly, and the kings-at-arms would be carefully examining the combatants like referees before a boxing match, to see that they were not stuck to their saddles. The referees at a judicial duel between a certain Earl of Salisbury and a Bishop of Salisbury, under the supposed King Edward III, found that the bishop's champion had prayers and incantations sewn all over him, under his armour, which was almost as bad as a boxer hiding a horseshoe in his glove. Below the window ledge, a pair of constipated papal nuncios might have been riding gloomily back to Rome. Such a pair were once sent with bulls to excommunicate Barnabas Visconti, but Barnabas only made them eat their bulls, parchment, ribbons, leaden seals, and all. Following closely behind them, perhaps there would have strode a professional pilgrim, supporting himself on a stout knobbed staff, shod like an alpenstock, and weighed down with blessed medals, relics, shells, vernicles, and so forth. He would have called himself a palmer, and if he were a well-travelled one, his relics might have included a feather from the angel Gabriel, some of the coals on which St. Lawrence was grilled, a finger of the Holy Ghost, whole and sound as ever it was, a vial of the sweat of St. Michael, whereas he fought with the devil, a little of the bush in which the Lord spake to Moses, a vest of St. Peter's, or some of the Blessed Virgin's milk preserved at Walsingham. After the palmer, perhaps, there would have prowled a rather more sinister figure, one of those who sleep by day and watch by night, eat well and drink well, but possess nothing. He would be an outlaw, of whom they wrote, "For an outlaw, this is the law, that men him take and bind without pity, hanged to be, and waver with the wind." But before he came to his last wavering in the wind, he would have lived a free life. His mate would be marching sturdily beside him, also with a price on her head, her hair shaven off before she took to the woods, and known as a wave. She would glance back occasionally, alert for the hue and cry with which they might be hunted. Here might come a baron with a hot pie, carried carefully before him, because he had to bring such a pie to the king once a year, so as to let King Arthur sniff it in payment of his feudal dues.
There might go another baron at full tilt after some dragon or other, and bump, down he might come while the horse cantered away. But if he did so, one of his attendants would immediately mount him again on his own horse, just as we would do to a master of hounds today, because that was the feudal law. In the distance of the north, under the fading sunset, there might spring up the cottage light of some busy witch who was not only making a wax image of somebody she disapproved of, but also getting the image baptized. This was the operative factor, before she stuck some pins into it. One of her priestly friends, by the way, who had gone to the little master, might be willing to say a requiem mass against anybody you wanted to dispose of. And when he came to the requiem aeternam dona ei domine, he would mean it, although the man was alive. Equally distant in the west, under the same sunset, you might have seen Enguerrand de Marigny, who built the enormous gallows at Montfaucon, himself rotting and clanking on the same gallows because he had been found guilty of black magic. The Dukes of Berry and Brittany, two decent men, might have been trotting along the road in satin cuirasses which imitated steel. These two did not like to accept the advantage of armour, and finding the satin cooler to wear, they were determined to be ordinary and brave. Lancelot might have done the same sort of thing. Above them on the hillside, but unobserved by them, might have sat Jolly Jolly Wat with his tar-box beside him. He was the most typical figure of gramarye, his tar being the antiseptic of his sheep. If you had said to him, "Don't spoil the ship for a ha'porth of tar," he would have agreed with you at once, for it was he who invented the adage which we have translated from sheep into ships. Towards the remoter distance, perhaps a bankrupt might have been getting a vigorous whacking in some Muscovite marketplace, not out of ill feeling towards himself, but in the fervent hope that if only he squealed loud enough, some of his friends or relations in the crowd would pay his debts out of commiseration. Further south, towards the Mediterranean basin, you might have seen a seaman being punished for gambling, under a law of Richard Coeur de Lion. The punishment consisted in being thrown into the water three times from the mainmast tree, and his comrades used to acclaim each belly flopper with a cheer. A third ingenious punishment might possibly have been inflicted in the marketplace below you. A wine merchant whose wares were of bad quality would have been stuck in the pillory, and there he would have been made to drink an excessive quantity of his own liquor, after which the rest would be poured over his head. What a headache next morning! In this direction, if you happened to be broad-minded, you might have been amused to see the saucy Alison, who cried tee-hee after she had been given the unusual kiss which Chaucer tells about. In that one, you might notice an exasperated miller and his family trying to straighten out the hurrah's nest which happened last night through the displacement of a cradle, as the Reeve tells in his tale. A schoolboy who had had the good luck and the initiative to shoot an Earl of Salisbury dead with one of the new-fangled cannons might be idolized by his fellow scholars in the playground of yonder monastery school. Plum trees, only lately introduced, like Merlin's mulberry, might be shedding blossom under the light of eve beside the playground. Another little boy, this time a king of 4 years old in Scotland, might be sadly issuing a royal mandate to his nanny, which empowered her to spank him without being guilty of high treason. A disreputable army, who used to live by the sword as a trained band, might be begging its bread from door to door, a good fate for all armies, and a man who had taken sanctuary in that church away to the east there might have had his leg cut off because he had taken half a step outside the door. In the same sanctuary there would be quite a congeries of forgers, thieves, murderers, and debtors, all busy forging away or sharpening their knives for the evening's outing in the restful seclusion of the church where they could not be arrested. The worst that could happen to them, once they had got their sanctuary, was banishment. Then they would have had to walk to Dover, always keeping to the middle of the road and clutching a crucifix. If they let go of it for a moment, you were allowed to attack them. And once there, if they could not get a boat immediately, they would have had to walk into the sea daily up to their necks to prove that they were really trying. Did you know that in these dark ages, which were visible from Guinevere's window, there was so much decency in the world that the Catholic Church could impose a peace to all their fighting, which it called the Truce of God, and which lasted from Wednesday to Monday, as well as during the whole of Advent and Lent? Do you think that they, with their battles, famine, black death, and serfdom, were less enlightened than we are, with our wars, blockade, influenza, and conscription? Even if they were foolish enough to believe that the earth was the center of the universe, do we not ourselves believe that man is the fine flower of creation? If it takes a million years for a fish to become a reptile, has man, in our few hundred, altered out of recognition? Chapter 4. Lancelot and Guinevere looked over the sundown of chivalry from the tower window. Their black profiles stood out in silhouette against the setting light. Lancelot's, the old, ugly man's, was the outline of a gargoyle. It might have looked in hideous meditation from Notre Dame, his contemporary church. But in its maturity, it was nobler than before. The lines of ugliness had sunk to rest as lines of strength. Like the bulldog, which is one of the most betrayed of dogs, Lancelot had grown a face which people could trust. The touching thing was that the two were singing. Their voices, no longer full in tone like those of people in the strength of youth, were still tenacious of the note. If they were thin, they were pure. They supported one another. "When that the month of May," sang Lancelot, "comes and the day in beams gives light, I fear no more the fight." "When," sang Guinevere, "when that the sonne, his daily course ironne, is no more bright, I fear no more the night." "But oh," they sang together, "but oh, both day and night, my heart's delight, must one day leave fordone, all might, all gone." They stopped, with an unexpected grace note on the portative, and Lancelot said, "Your voice is good. I'm afraid mine is getting rusty." "You shouldn't drink spirits." "What an unfair thing to say! I have been nearly a teetotaler since the Grail." "Well, I had rather you didn't drink at all." "Then I won't drink, not even water. I will die of thirst at your feet, and Arthur will give me a splendid funeral and never forgive you for making me."
"Yes, and I shall go into a nunnery for my sins and live happily ever after. What shall we sing now?"
Lancelot said, "Nothing. I don't want to sing. Come and sit close to me, Jenny."
"Are you unhappy about something?"
"No, I was never so happy in my life, and I dare say I shall never be so happy again."
"Why so happy?"
"I don't know. It is because the spring has come after all, and there is the bright summer in front of us. Your arms will go brown again, just a flush along the top here, and a rosy round elbow. I'm not sure I don't like the places where you bend best, like the insides of your elbows."
Guinevere retreated from these charming compliments. "I wonder what Arthur is doing."
"Arthur is visiting the Gawains, and I am talking about your elbows."
"I see."
"Jenny, I was happy because you were ordering me about. That's the explanation. You were nagging about me not drinking too much. I like you to look after me and to tell me what I ought to do."
"You seem to need it."
"I do need it," he said.
And then,
with a suddenness which surprised them both. "May I come tonight?"
"No."
"Why not?"
"Lance, please don't ask. You know that Arthur is at home, and it is much too dangerous."
"Arthur won't mind."
"If Arthur were to catch us," she said wisely, "he would have to kill us."
He denied it. "Arthur knows all about us. Merlin warned him in so many words, and Morgan le Fay sent him two broad hints. And then there was the trouble with Sir Meliagrance. But he doesn't want to have things upset. He would never catch us unless he was made to."
"Lancelot," she said angrily, "I am not going to have you talking about Arthur as if he were a go-between."
"I am not talking about him like that. He was my first friend, and I love him."
"Then you are talking about me as if I were worse."
"And now you are behaving as if you were." "Very well. If that is all you have to say, you had better go." "So that you can make love to him, I suppose."
"Lancelot!"
"Oh, Jenny!" He jumped up, nimble as ever, and caught her. "Don't be angry. I'm sorry if I was unkind."
"Go away. Leave me alone."
But he continued to hold her tightly, like someone restraining a wild animal from running away. "Don't be angry. I am sorry. You know I didn't mean it."
"You are a beast."
"No, I am not a beast, and nor are you. Jenny, I shall go on holding you until you stop being cross. I said it because I was miserable."
Her muffled and restrained voice remarked plaintively, "You said you were happy just now."
"Well, I am not happy. I am very unhappy and miserable about the whole world."
"Do you suppose you are the only one?"
"No, I don't. And I'm sorry for what I said. It will make me unhappy for having said it. There, please be a dear and don't make me unhappy for longer." She relented. The years had smoothed their earlier tempers.
"Then I won't."
But her smile and yielding only moved him afresh. "Come away with me, Jenny."
"Please don't start it all over again."
"I can't help starting," he said desperately. "I don't know what to do. God, we have been going over this all our lives, but it seems to be worse in the spring. Why won't you come with me to Joyous Gard and have the whole thing above board?"
"Lance, let go of me and be sensible. There, sit down and we will have another song."
"But I don't want to sing.
And I don't want to have all this.
If you would come with me to Joyous Gard, it would be finished, once for all. We could live together for our old age anyway and be happy, and not have to go on deceiving every day, and we should die in peace."
"You said that Arthur knew all about it," she said, "and that we were not deceiving him at all."
"Yes, but it is different. I love Arthur, and I can't stand it when I see him looking at me and know that he knows. You see, Arthur loves us."
"But, Lance, if you love him so much, what is the good of running away with his wife?"
"I wanted to be in the open," he said stubbornly, "at least at the end."
"Well, I don't want it to be."
"In fact," and now he was furious again, "what you really want is to have two husbands. Women always want everything."
She declined the quarrel patiently. "I don't want to have two husbands, and I am just as uncomfortable as you are. But what is the good of being in the open? As we are now, it is horrible, but at least Arthur knows about it inside himself, and we still love each other and are safe. If I were to run away with you, the result would be that everything would be broken. Arthur would have to declare war on you and lay siege to Joyous Gard, and then one or other of you would be killed, if not both, and hundreds of other people would be killed, and nobody would be better off. Besides, I don't want to leave Arthur. When I married him, I promised to stay with him, and he has always been kind to me, and I'm fond of him. The least I can do is to go on giving him a home and helping him, even if I do love you too. I can't see the point of being in the open. Why should we make Arthur publicly miserable? Neither of them had noticed, in the deepening twilight, that the king himself had come in as she was speaking. Profiled against the window, they could see little of the room behind. But he had entered. He had stood for the fraction of a second collecting his wits, which had been far away considering the Orkneys or some other matter of state. He had stopped in the curtained doorway, his pale hand with the royal signet gleaming in the darkness as it held the tapestry aside. And then, without eavesdropping for a moment, he had let the tapestry fall and disappeared. He had gone to find Paige to announce him. "The only decent thing," Lancelot was saying, twisting his hands together between his knees, "the only decent thing would be for me to go away and not come back. But my brain didn't stand it the other time when I tried."
"My poor Lance, if only we had not stopped singing. Now you are going to get into a state again and have one of your attacks. Why can't we leave everything alone and let your famous god look after it? It is no good trying to think or do anything because it is right or wrong. I don't know what is right or wrong. But can't we trust ourselves and do what does itself and hope for the best?"
"You are his wife, and I am his friend."
"Well," she said, "who made us love each other?"
"Jenny, I don't know what to do."
"Then don't do anything. Come here and give me a kind kiss, and God will look after us both."
"My sweetheart."
This time the page clattered up the stairs with the usual noise in the way of pages, bringing light with him at the same time. Arthur had ordered the candles. The room glowed into colour round the lovers, who had released each other quickly. It began to show the splendours of its hangings as the boy put fire to the wicks. The flowery meads and bird-fruitful spinneys of the arras teemed and rippled over the four walls. The door curtain lifted again, and the king was in the room. He looked old, older than either of them. But it was the noble oldness of self-respect. Sometimes, even nowadays, you can meet a man of 60 or more who holds himself as straight as a rush and whose hair is black. They were in that class. Lancelot, now that you could see him clearly, was an erect refinement of humanity, a fanatic for human responsibility. Guinevere, and this might have been surprising to a person who had known her in her days of tempest, looked sweet and pretty. You could almost have protected her. But Arthur was the touching one of the three. He was so plainly dressed, so gentle and patient of his simple things. Often when the Queen was entertaining distinguished company under the flambeau of the great hall, Lancelot had found him sitting by himself in a small room, mending stockings. Now, in his homely blue gown — blue, since it was an expensive tincture in those days, was reserved for kings or for saints and angels in pictures — he paused on the threshold of the gleaming room and smiled.
"Well, Lance. Well, Gwen."
Guinevere, still breathing quickly, returned his greeting.
"Well, Arthur, you took us by surprise."
"I am sorry. I've only just got back." "How were the Gawains?" asked Lancelot, in the old tone which he had never succeeded in making natural.
"They were having a fight when I arrived."
"How like them!" they exclaimed. "What did you do? What were they fighting about?"
They made it sound as if it were a matter of life or death, getting the mood wrong because of their own. The king looked steadily in front of him.
"I didn't ask."
"Some family affair," said the Queen, "no doubt."
"No doubt it was."
"I hope nobody got hurt."
"Nobody got hurt."
"Well, then," she cried, noticing that her relief sounded absurd, "that was all right."
Yes, that was all right. They saw that his eyes were twinkling. He was amused at their trouble, and the atmosphere was normal.
Now, said the king, need we talk about the Gawains any more? Do I never get a kiss from my wife?
Dear.
She drew his head towards her and kissed him on the forehead, thinking of him as a faithful old thing, her friendly bear. Lancelot stood up.
Perhaps I ought to be off.
Don't go, Lance. It is nice to have you to ourselves for a little. Come, sit by the fire and sing us a song. We shall be able to do without the fires soon.
So we shall, said Guinevere. Fancy, it will soon be summer.
Still, it is nice to sit by the fire, at home. It is nice for you in your home, said Lancelot peculiarly.
But what?
I have no home.
Never mind, Lance, you will. Wait until you are my age, and then start worrying about it.
It is not, said the Queen, as if every woman you met didn't chase you for miles.
With a hatchet, added Arthur.
Half of them actually propose.
And then you complain about not having a home.
Lancelot began to laugh, and the last strand of tension seemed to be broken.
Would you, he asked, marry a woman who chased you with a hatchet?
The king considered the matter gravely before he answered.
I couldn't do that, he said in the end, because I am married already.
To Gwen, said Lancelot.
It was peculiar. They seemed to have started talking with meanings which were separate from the words they used. It was like ants talking with their antennae.
To Queen Guinevere, said the king, in contradiction.
Or Jenny, suggested the queen.
Yes, he agreed, but only after a long pause. Or Jenny.
There was a deeper silence, until Lancelot rose for the second time.
Well, I must go.
Arthur put one hand on his arm.
No, Lance, stay a minute.
I want to tell Guinevere something this evening, and I would like you to hear it too. We have been together such a long time. I want to make a clean breast about an old business to both of you, because you are one of the family.
Lancelot sat down. That's right. Now, give me a hand, each, both of you, and I shall sit between you like this. There. My queen and my lance. And neither of you is to blame me for what I'm going to tell.
Lancelot said bitterly, We are not in a position to blame people, King.
No? Well, I don't know what you mean by that, but I want to tell you the story of something which I did when I was young. It was before I was married to Gwen, long before you were knighted. Will you mind if I do that? Of course we shan't mind if you want to.
But we don't believe you did anything wrong.
It started before I was born, really, for my father fell in love with the Countess of Cornwall and killed the Earl in order to get her. She was my mother. You know that part of the story. Yes. Perhaps you didn't know that I was born at rather an awkward date. It was too soon after the marriage of my father and mother. That was why they hushed me up altogether and sent me off in my swaddling bands to be brought up by Sir Ector. Merlin was the person who took me. And then, said Lancelot cheerfully, you were brought back to court when your father died, and pulled a magic sword out of a stone, which proved that you were the rightful king, born of all England, and lived happily ever afterward. And that was the end of that. I don't call that a bad story. Unfortunately, that was not the end.
How?
Well, my dears, I was taken away from my mother the moment I was born, and she never knew where I was taken. Nor did I know who my mother was. The only people who knew the relationship between us were Uther Pendragon and Merlin. Many years afterward, when I was already a king, I met my mother's family, still without knowing who they were. Uther was dead, and Merlin was always so muddled with his second sight that he had forgotten to tell me. And so we met as strangers. I thought that one of them was clever and handsome.
The famous Cornwall sisters, mentioned the Queen coldly.
Yes, dear, the famous Cornwall sisters. There were three daughters by the former Earl, and of course, though I did not know it, they were my half-sisters. They were called Morgan le Fay, Elaine, and Morgawes, and they were considered to be the most beautiful women in Britain. They waited for his quiet voice to resume, which it did without a falter. I fell in love with Morgawes, it added, and we had a baby.
If either of them felt surprise, resentment, commiseration, or envy, they did not show it. The only surprising thing to them was that the secret had been kept so long. But they could tell from his voice that he was suffering and that he did not want to be interrupted until he had purged his heart in full. They stared into the fire for the longest of their silences. Then Arthur shrugged his shoulders.
"So you see," he said, "I am Mordred's father. Gawain and the others are nephews, but he is my full son."
Lancelot saw by the eyes that he might speak.
"I don't think your story is wicked even at that. You didn't know she was your half-sister. You hadn't met Gwen. And probably, knowing her subsequent history, it was the fault of Morgawes in any case. That woman was a devil." "She was my sister, and the mother of my son."
Guinevere stroked his hand. "I am sorry."
"Besides," he said, "she was a very beautiful creature."
"Morgawes," began Lancelot,
"Morgawes has paid for her share by having her head cut off, so we must leave her to rest in peace."
"Cut off," said Lancelot, "by her own child, because he found her sleeping with Sir Lamorack. Please, Lancelot."
"I'm sorry."
"I still don't think it was wicked of you, Arthur. After all, you didn't know she was your sister." The king took a long breath and began again, more huskily.
"I have not told you," he said, "the worst part of what I did."
"What was that?"
"You see, I was young. I was 19. And Merlin came too late to say what had happened. Everybody told me what a dreadful sin it was, and how nothing but sorrow would come of it, and also a lot of other things about what Mordred would be like if he was born. They frightened me with horrible prophecies, and I did something which has haunted me ever since. Our mother had hidden Morgawes away as soon as it was known."
"What did you do?"
"I let them make a proclamation that all the children born at a certain time were to be put in a big ship and floated out to sea. I wanted to destroy Mordred for his own sake, and I didn't know where he would be born."
"Did they do it?"
"Yes. The ship was floated off, and Mordred was on it, and it was wrecked on an island. Most of the poor babies were drowned, but God saved Mordred and sent him back to shame me afterwards. Morgawes sprang him on me one day, long after she had got him back. but she always pretended to other people that he was a proper son of Lot's, like Gawain and the rest. Naturally, she didn't want to talk about the business to outside people, and neither have the rest of his brothers.
Well, said Guinevere, if nobody knows about it except the Orkneys and ourselves, and if Mordred is safe and sound...
You mustn't forget the other babies, he said miserably. I dream about them.
Why didn't you tell us before?
I was ashamed to.
This time Lancelot exploded. Arthur, he exclaimed, you have nothing to be ashamed of. What you did was done to you, when you were too young to know better. If I could lay my hands on the brutes who frighten children with stories about sin, I would break their necks. What good does it do? Think of all that suffering, and for nothing. And the poor babies.
All drowned.
They sat again, looking into the flames, until Guinevere turned to her husband.
Arthur, she asked, why did you tell the story today?
He waited, collecting the words.
It is because I am afraid that Mordred bears me a grudge, poor boy, and rightly too.
Treason? Inquired the commander-in-chief.
Well, not exactly treason, Lance, but I think he is dissatisfied.
Cut the sniveller's head off and have done with him.
No, I could never think of it. You forget that Mordred is my son. I am fond of him. I have done the boy a great deal of wrong, and my family has always somehow been hurting the Cornwalls, and I couldn't add to the wickedness. Besides, I am his father. I can see myself in him. There does not seem to be a great resemblance, but there is. Mordred is ambitious and fond of honour, as I always was. It is only because he has a weak body that he has failed in our sports, and this has embittered him, as it probably would have embittered me if I had not been lucky. He is brave, too, in a queer way, and he is loyal to his people. You see, his mother set him against me, which was natural, and I stand for the bad things in his mind. He's almost sure to get me killed in the end. Are you seriously advancing this as a reason for not killing him now?